Good morning. I would like firstly to thank the organizers to give me the opportunity to take part in this very interesting workshop. And actually, I am from Naples, Italy, and Naples is a town that is very close to Vesuvio. Vesuvio, it does this? What is it? And actually, Vesuvio is the volcano that 2,000 years ago destroyed Pompeii and Ercolano. So every morning that you open the window and you look at the volcano, you think, will it erupt? And actually, it reminds you of how important it is to be accurate in your predictions, especially when you think about volcanoes and medical applications. So actually today I want to talk about the application of supervised learning to macro-array data. Actually the previous speakers did a very good work, so I just took some of the slides away because some of the things that I was going to say were already contained in the previous presentation. But still, let's say when this macro-array story began. No, this was in 1995 when some researchers described the fact that they were capable to detect the gene expression value for a set of genes contemporarily. So they were capable to detect the gene expression of about 70 genes altogether. And so this opened the way to these new high throughput methodologies that were capable to see this gene expression. And since that time, if you now you do a search on PubMed looking for the word macroarray, you find that there are about 36,000 publications. And now it's very cheap to do experiments on macroarray, but at the beginning it could cost about $30,000 each of those publications, $30,000. So you can well understand how much money there is in this publication only related to experiments. We are not talking about building the laboratories, buying the equipment, and paying the people to work. And in this publication are described the results of 240,000 profiles. So these are a single, actually an experiment is composed of a few tens of profiles. So there is a large quantity of data that is publicly available. This is just one database among many that are available on the World Wide Web. So you can just download the data and try your algorithms to see how they work. So this is an opportunity that we have, this is an opportunity to test our ideas. So actually, this is what I understand of how macroarrays work. Actually, what you get is a glass slide on which there are some spots, and those spots actually reveal the level of expression of each gene. So what happens is that you have a matrix that is on the columns there are the samples, and on the rows there are the probes. The probes are pieces of DNA on which you can map genes. So there is a way to map the part of the genes on these single pieces of DNA. And the color of the spot reveals the intensity of the expression of this gene. Correlated to the expression of a gene, there is the production of a protein. And as we know, proteins do most of the work within the cell, both proteins and protein-protein interactions. Now the macroarray gives you this film, and you have to get numbers from this film. And actually in this process what happens is that you commit errors. So what happens is that when you try to detect which is the number associated to a single spot, you are not always capable to do this because the spot is slightly moved on one side, or it's not clearly printed on the glass film. So the process is actually to put a grid on this film, and in each cell of the grid try to understand which is the value that is associated. As I told you, the experiments are very expensive, so people want numbers, want results from the experiments, and that's what the machine gives you. Gives you numbers, but how good are those numbers is not always clear, no? And and it is not always clear. And so what you end up with a very large matrix of numbers that are affected by errors, or in which number itself has been somehow computed, but it was not actually in the experiment itself. So we can see this, for example, in this slide, in which we have the various probes that are on a chipset. There are from 7,000 to 40,000 of those probes that are mapped. This is, for example, an Affymetrix generated file. That is one of the technologies available. And here this is the level of expression in this sample. And here there is a letter. And there is an A, a P, sometimes an M. And actually, A means absent. So that value was not computed by my machine, but somehow was inferred. So there is a method to assign a number where it is not available. And there are many A's in these files. So many of these numbers have been imputed somehow. And there are also some M. M means that the confidence that you have in the computed number is not very high. The p-value associated to that number is not little enough. So, but we have to cope with this. Now, this is the numbers that we have, and we have to use them. So, let's see what can be a way to analyze this kind of data. There are many, many applications of macro arrays here. There are just a few other data sets on which I've been working, so are the ones that probably I know a little bit better. And as you can see, people have been trying to do many, many different things using macro arrays. For example, they have been trying to predict the patient outcome after prostatectomy. There is that work on Van Pert, on which there is a patent. There is also a kit for the breast cancer, so you can use this kit to predict, if you will, the outcome of a breast cancer. Other people have been trying to compare. This example has been already shown some various subtypes of the same illness. This is particularly interesting because leukemia, people that are affected by different kind of leukemia respond in different way to chemotherapy. So it is what you want to do is to give as little chemotherapy as possible to the people that are in need, and you don't want to mess up with those. You don't want to misclassify those people. So there are many, many applications of those macro arrays that have been around. But what are actually the challenges that we are facing in them? As we have seen, the biologists are a very well organized community, and all the data becomes very soon available. If they publish a paper in a journal, they will have the associated data set somewhere. So you always find all the data all around. Actually, the comparison, as we were saying this morning, is not always easy. There are some publications that tells you how to compare outcomes from different technologies, from different macro arrays. For example, if you use an Affymetrix data array, or you use an Illumina that is a two-channel macro array, how do you compare the results? And also the mapping, because the mapping is something that is very well related to the chip that you are using. But still, and so you have some ways to compare data, and you can build up very large bunch of very large data sets. Each of these data sets, as I said, has tens of thousands of probes of genes. And now we will indifferently spoke about probes and genes, although this is not completely correct. And what happens is that you end up with those big matrices. Here, for each number, there is a color. The higher the number, red, the darker is the color. The lower the number, greener is the color. And so on the columns of these matrices, you find, for example, patients. And on the rows, you find, again, genes. And the number is the level of expression of each gene. So you have problems that, from a mathematical point of view, live in a space with a very high dimensionality, no? 10,000 of dimensions, 40,000 dimensions, and so on. And so what happens is that since this data is affected by errors, what happens is that the model that you provide usually stick to the data, try to classify this data in classes, and what happens is that they are too close to the data, and so they do not generalize well, because they take into account also the errors. This morning we heard about SVM classification and supervised learning. I like to say that a method, the supervised learning method, is a method that is an algorithm that is capable to answer questions. Now, in the simplest form, it can answer questions that have only two possible answers: yes or no, ill or healthy and black or white and so on. So you take a bunch of, you take a training set that is a set of questions for which you know the answer. From the characteristic of these questions, you train your algorithm and then you try to provide answers for questions for which you do not have an answer. And this is actually called supervised because you are meaning that the answers that you have are certain. They have been provided by a teacher, so you do not commit errors on this training set. And as I said, binary classification is among the simplest form, but also the most successful methods for supervised learning. Actually, in the afternoon, I think Petos will show also the generalization to multi-class of those methods. And among the methods, the most successful methods in supervised learning, in binary classification and binary classification, they are support vector machines. Support vector, the idea of support vector machines has been around since a long time. No? The fact that every discrimination problem could be posed as a classification problem is something that dates back to the 60s. Although the complete theory about the prediction capabilities of those algorithms only arrived in 1995 or so. So why we like support vector machines? Because they are based, actually when you solve support vector machines, you are solving an optimization problem. So you have all the theory behind that assures you, that tells you how this will go, if there are solutions and so on. And actually, there is also another reason why people like SVM is the fact that there is a theory, the statistical learning theory, that tells you, as I said, the prediction capability of those algorithms. So you already know how bad you can do when you do a prediction with those algorithms. Actually, the training set, as we have seen, is a quadratic optimization, quadratic convex cost function, so it's a quadratic programming problem, and for this there are many methods available. If you go to the Vapnik book, when he talks about SVM, he also gives some references on methods that can be used to solve this problem. And many, many more methods are available since 1995. And also the implementation are widespread. So you want to use a support vector machine in MATLAB, you have the implementation. You want to use it in R, you have the implementation. And so on, WAKE and many problem solving environments. And also you have libraries and classes that you can use in programming languages. Actually, the life is not always linear, we know, and the things are sometimes messed up. So not always is possible to find a single line that separates two classes of points. And to do this, what you do, you use the kernel method. I talk about method because this morning Steve talked about the kernels again. So it's the second time, it's not a trick anymore. Right, as Panos said. So I just changed and I put method on there. So, for example, for this data set, if you take the light points and the dark points, you cannot find a line that separates the points. No, there is no single line that provides a separation among those points. But what you can do is just to take this bidimensional problem and put it in a three-dimensional space. For example, you can bend the plane on which those points lie to find a separation. So what you do is just, for example, you bend the plane. So the darkest points will go on top of this mountain, or this small mountain, whereas the others will remain down. And now you can find the linear separation, no? It's not difficult. You can take an hyperplane and you can just provide a separation. Of course, and so the points, the lighter points will be below this hyperplane, whereas the darker points will be on top. So you have a linear separation in a different space. Now you have to come back. When you come back, what you obtain is this line here, no? Is this separation. So when you come back, you obtain a separation that is not a line anymore, and you cannot give the analytic formulation of this classification model. What you can do every time you have a new point, to understand if it is in one class or in another, so you want to ask the question, what you have to do is to project it in this space with this nonlinear transformation and see in which class it belongs. This is a very powerful method, and there are many applications which has been successfully used. And it has been successfully used. But actually, there are also some limits to support vector machines. Probably the most notable one is the fact that it is a, we said there is a quadratic programming problem, and the deviation grows as with the square of the dimension of the number of the training set points. So there are other ways to express the classification problem. Now we are not saying anymore, I just drew a line that separates the two sets. But what we do is we look for a line that is as close as possible to the points of one set and as far as possible from the points of the other set. This is somehow a constrained regression, no? So you try to describe the point of a class with a line. This line is as close as possible to those points and the farther possible from the other points. The formulation of this point, of this problem in this way, is that one. So you try to minimize, in the least square sense, the distance from this line from the points of A from the points of B. So A and B are the matrices that contain for each, on each row the points in this space. This is a very nice formula. This is a very nice formulation. Actually, if a new point arrives, you cannot say it's on the left, on the right of the discrimination surface, but you have to compute the distance. So if a new point arrives and you want to know if it's A or B, you have to compute the distance from those lines, one for each class, and you will assign the point to the class that is for which the line is closer to the point itself. So what happens is in this case that you will say that this point is a B point class. Also for this kind of models, of classification models, you can use the kernel trick. So if you call gamma the set, for example, the training set, let's start with this. What happens is that you can project more linearly the points in a space of a larger dimension. So what you actually do, I have been using the Gaussian kernel, as Steve was mentioning this morning, and what you do is actually you build the representation of, for example, of A class in this new space, this is a nonlinear transformation, and what you do is actually that for each point E, the J feature will be computed using the I row of A and the J row of the complete training set. So this is this is the representation of A in this new space, its projection. And so what you end up with the same problem in which you do not have the representation of the matrix anymore, but you do not have the matrix in itself anymore, but you have its representation in the new space. So again, this is a very nice problem, because with a very simple position, you just recognize that this is equivalent to minimize this problem. Okay, where Z actually is exactly the coefficient of the plane that you are looking for in the other space, in the nonlinear space. But this is the Rayleigh quotient of this generalized eigenvalue problem. So this is if H is a positive definite, the stationary points will be achieved in the eigenvectors, and since the value of the cost function is the eigenvalue in itself, to find the minimum you just have to look for the eigenvectors, the eigenvector that is related to the minimum eigenvalue. So you just compute one eigenvector and one eigenvalue, and the eigenvector in itself will tell you which is the classification model for each class. So very simple. No? In the sense that there are many software that implement this, and you can use them. So the question now, why another method we can answer? Why are we proposing a new religion, a new method to classify points? Well, first of all, because linear algebra has been widely, extensively studied in the last 30 years, no? Numerical linear algebra. And so there are many libraries, there are many solvers. For example, at the University of Tennessee, it has been implemented a very large, very large library, namely the LAPAC, to solve this kind of problems. And this also works in on parallel computers. This also works in case you have sparse data. It also works on grids, on computational grids. You already have all the software, and if you have your computational grid already deployed, you can just use the software that is available. Actually, there are also other advantages. For example, but only in the case of, in the linear case, this algorithm scales linearly with the number of training, the computational complexity of the linear classifier scales linearly with the number of training points. That is very good. No, the computational complexity is linear. And actually also the fact that, as I said, in many problem-solving environments, the algorithm itself becomes one line of code. Compute the minimum eigenvector of this problem. So very easy to implement. So there are some advantages, but of course there are also some drawbacks. First of all, the problem is this, that in some cases the problem can be ill-posed. So it does not have a single solution, but there's more solutions associated to, there are more eigenvectors associated to the minimum eigenvalue. So the Mangasarian proposed, Mangasarian proposed to do a regularization, no? So to add that term, so that we shift a little bit the problem, so that the new problem only has one solution, exactly one solution. But what happens is that you have to solve two problems. So we thought about this, and we came up with a different regularization strategy that could provide with one single eigenvalue problem could provide the solution. So you just half the computational time, the time you need to compute the classification model. Then we realized that both those regularizations are related to the robustness of the algorithm. So this is a way to introduce robustness in the algorithm. I will not talk about this right now, but probably if there will be another workshop in Toronto, I will be very pleased to take part and to describe this part. And so, but this is important because the regularization is equivalent to robustness. So we are introducing a way to be resilient to noise in data. Okay. What are the drawbacks? What are the other drawbacks? I don't know if you can see, but here we have classified the plane in two classes. So now the linear classification model in the other space is now this very curly line that goes around and divides in many pieces. So this is the effect of overfitting. This is the effect of noisy data. What happens is that the classification model tries to classify every single point. So if there is an error, a noise, it just produces some strange classification surfaces. And we want to avoid this. How do we do this? Actually, we try to do this in a way that will be also useful for the very large data set. And also in the case that data is not completely available all at the same time. So you have some data that is coming little by little. But this is something that happens in biology because the experiments are not all available at the same time. No, but little by little they are arriving. So how to solve the problem? This guy here is Tiger Wood. He's very well known for many things, but actually also for the fact that he can play golf very well. No. And actually, when you think at his and how he plays, what do you think? You think that he's not remembering all the games that he has played in his life, no? And also that he's starting from some shots that are very good from the very beginning, because he has been always a champion, no? Not from a certain point, no? From a certain point in time after, but he has always been good. So he has a way to increment his knowledge, of course, little by little playing, but also to detect which are the shots that are most useful in that particular case. And so we try to apply this idea to an incremental technique in the learning process. So we decided to train our algorithm little by little, adding points little by little. And this is a very interesting idea because, as I said, you can use it in case of streams of data, in the case that you have you have data that is coming in chunks, because you do not have to retrain every time completely your algorithm, but you can just add the points that are useful for your classification. You have to start, of course, from a robust subset of points, as a Tiger that is starting from a robust subset of shots. And you will increment your knowledge. Actually, the algorithm looks difficult, but the idea is very, very simple. So let's say that we start with a very little number of points, and we train our classifier. Now we have another point in the training set. This point probably is bringing an information that we already have, so we don't need it, no? So we can throw away. or probably it has an information that we do not already have. This means that it will change the classification model, but will not change the way in which we are thinking about our data. The third case is that this is an error, it's an outlier. So it will completely change our vision of the data. So it will change our classification model. And so we have to be very careful and we have to throw it away. So every time we take one point at a time, and what we do? We just take the point that looks the worst in our case. We just we train our machine on a small subset of points C0. And then what we do, we take the point that is the farthest from his hyperplane. We know the label because those points are in the training set. And so we take the one that has been misclassified by the actual model, the model that we have at 10. We add to the training set and we ask, are we doing better or not? If you are doing better, we need this point. It is bringing an information that is consistent with what we know, and it's probably adding something more. Or what can happen is that the accuracy goes down. This means that this point is not good because it's telling us something that is not that does not relate to what we know. Actually, this is a general. So we accept a point if it increases the accuracy on the training set. So we are going up on the accuracy. Of course, we can do this with different. We can ask different things. We can ask to minimize the number of false positives if we have a special case in which the classes are not the same, they have not the same meaning, or we can do whatever we like. And what is interesting is also that we are not talking about a specific algorithm, no? I just put classify. But we are talking in general of a classification algorithm that can be trained, and so you can train it little by little. The results that you obtain with this technique are very nice. Here we have a plot in which the dark, I don't know if you can see from there, the dark points are one class and the light points are in the other class. And this is the same picture that I showed you before without, you know, which there were only the boundaries. And this is the new classification model that we obtain using this incremental strategy. And just as you look at it, you see that the surfaces are smoother. So you do not have anymore the problem of overfitting, the model overfitting in data. And actually, you also notice that there is a slight increment in accuracy. In classification accuracy, but what is impressive is the number of points that you need to classify to train your classifier. Only 5%. Since those points represent, in case of biomedical application, represent experiments, and experiments means money, what we are saying is that you can reduce your expenses, you can reduce the amount of money you need just training your machine in an appropriate way. Actually, how do you choose this initial point? So we shift our problem from one to another. So we have to choose this reliable subset that is very good. We decided to use an unsupervised clustering technique. So we just decided to ask a clustering technique to detect which were the points of each class that were best describing that class. And then we tried to prove that this was a good choice. And what we did was actually this. This is the banana dataset, it's called, because you see, this is a class of points, the black points, that is like a banana. This is another banana of points in another class. And this is another little banana. How is it called? in the first class. So there are various bananas going up and down. And so we just, this is a bidimensional dataset. So what we did is we took a sample, in the top picture, we took a sample of the points randomly, we trained the classifier, and we were asking each point to which class it belonged. So if it was always classified in the same class, it is white. If 50% of the times that point of the plane is in one class, 50% of the time in the other class, we put it black. We do this 100 times, and we see what we have, what happens. So the white areas means that the classifiers, whatever is the initial point selection, are always classified in the same class. The black areas means that 50% of the times the classifiers throw that point in one class, other 50% of the time in the other class. And as we see that the white areas, in the case you use unsupervised learning as initial point selection, is much wider. And the uncertainty is just on the boundary, as it is, usually it is normal that it is. When if a point is here, you don't know in which class it is. So, and we see that the white areas are much wider than in the other case. So, with the, and actually we also see that the accuracy, if you use the skimmings, is a little bit higher than in the other case, but and also the regions are much better. As I said, what is impressive is the number of training points that you need to train. So we took some UCI dataset and we just saw what was happening. And what we see that in the percentage of training points is very little. And actually the accuracy is comparable with the initial method. We are using just few elements, so we think that the accuracy will be a little bit slower. And it's still comparable with the SVM, that for us is still the target classification, the target classification method. So what we can say that the incremental learning with the REGEC actually reduces the training set and maintains comparable accuracy results. But how do we apply this to macro arrays? That is the end of our story. And actually, we will. The problem, as we know, is that macro arrays have few samples and many features. So we have a problem because the problem is difficult to solve. And also we have, as we said, we have the this noise. So we decided that if we were incrementing the number of points, then we were decrementing the number of features that we were taking into account. So we start from the big picture, we take all the features that we have, and we see if we can take some of the features, some of the probes away, the ones that are less relevant. This is a shift in the way in which the feature selection techniques have been applied. Actually, this is still feature selection. There is a lot of work on this. There are many papers. There are many methodologies. There are many taxonomies. But still, this method, since it starts from a small bunch of training points, actually it's much faster than reduced feature elimination, relief, and many other methods that try to come up with a set of probes that are important for classification. And this also gives results that are more accurate than standard statistical methods like Fisher discriminant, linear discriminant, and so on. And the criteria to throw away the probes was just to look at this is a diminishment of the Fisher the Fisher criterion. So we take the means of the two samples of the two classes for a particular probe, and we look if these values are very different. If the values are very different, then this means that this feature, this probe is important in the discrimination process, and we keep. If it's very low, this means that the values are all more or less the same in all the samples, the probe has more or less the same value in all the samples of the dataset, so in both classes. And so we just throw this probe because it's not useful. And of course, this is in the measure of the standard, of the sum of the standard deviation of the two classes. We applied this to many datasets. I just show you one. This is the Golub. It has been described, and as Panos said, this is the representation of the dataset in the first two principal components, in the space spanned by the two first principal components. It's not exactly linear, as you can see, no? So there will be no perfect separation. And actually, what happens is that when you do cross-validation, you obtain a 96.86% of accuracy. So this is not perfect accuracy, but is interesting. And actually, what comes out is that it selects about 100 genes. If we compare those genes with the one that were in the initial publication, we find in the initial publication there were about, if I well remember, about 50. And I think that 25 of those we also find here. Some others are in publications that are more recent than the one that we were addressing. There were some others that were in no publication, but still they were related with blood and other things. So maybe they are also interesting. And we plotted this nice picture. So we took the sample from AML, we took the sample from ALL, from the two, and we separate. And then we took the first 100 genes that for us were discriminating, and the less discriminating 100 genes. No, what we see is that here the separation is clear, while here there is no separation. So this, for us, is also a result. So this is where we are now. But what's next? No, what will be next? We know that nowadays the technology is changing. We are not using macro arrays as we used to use. But there are some new technologies that are called deep sequencer that can provide both the sequence of the genome and the gene expression. But those machines produce the same kind of data, so noisy data, incomplete data, very difficult to analyze, with a number of features that is much higher than the one we have now. So we have to devise other techniques that can handle this quantity of data that is even larger than before. But still, there are some recent publications that says that if you can predict microRNA, then you have a base for the to understand better how cancer spreads in human and animal beings. So, first of all, deep sequencing. Another thing that is very interesting is system biology, of course. We have this metabolic data, we have this genomic data, we have this proteomic, interatomic data, many, many kind of data. But we are all looking at the same problem from various perspectives. We want to put everything together. So to do this, we have to devise new methods, because those kind of data are not comparable with each other. And in this case, what we are facing are very complex networks, very large complex networks. So also the techniques need to be devised, taking into account the very large size of this data, and the fact that we are talking about graphs and not more about matrices. Last but not least, I was thinking yesterday, because we were talking yesterday evening, and actually it seems like there is a shift. No? All these studies of the early 2000s talk about a bunch of patients, and they try to describe a situation starting from these 80-100 patients. But what happens if we try to look at the single person? So we need to change the way in which we store data. Now, if we want to look at the single person and we want to say something about him and not about the population, I use the word population, but I'm not sure is the correct word. I'm sorry for my English. But actually, you want to look at the single person. This changes completely the paradigm that we are using to store data, to retrieve data, to analyze data. And so probably we have to think about this a little bit more. So this is to conclude, because it's time. This is a moment in which technology is pushing very much. We have new machines every year, we have new technology coming out. They are not perfect, they are noisy, they produce incomplete data, but still they are viable. And now, let's say that people that start methods are running, no? Mathematicians or computer scientists or whatever we can call, are running very fast, trying to solve the problems that are posed by these new technologies. And these problems, as I said, are various, no? The size, the noise, the incompleteness. And the question is, are we ready? No, are our techniques ready? I say this for a reason, because when you look at a very nice paper in an high-impact journal, what you see is a very new machine and a very old method. No, you see, for example, an high-throughput machine, and you see k-means. So there is a 60 years difference, no? In the moment in which the machine has been devised and the moment in which the algorithm has been devised. Does it mean that nothing has come out in these 60 years? What does it mean? I mean, there is something that is, no? That is not coherent. Of course, disciplines progress at different speeds. This is true. But still, there is a huge gap that means something. Thank you.